Everything in life has a more sinister and darker side than what is perceived on the surface. Every piece of media you consume has something lurking in the shadows of the person or team who made it. Every movie, every song, every book that you've enjoyed has a dark past in some form. But out of all of those, it seems video games have the capability to house some of the most dark and twisted parts of the creator's mind. From obvious inclusions like Silent Hill's PT, to the most lighthearted games such as Mario, we will pluck every strand of every creepy and twisted mystery these games have to offer. This is The Dark Side of Gaming. Some of you may already be familiar with Squaresoft USA's Secret of Evermore for Super Nintendo, but you may not know it was originally designed with a different storyline. The 1995 RPG was truly ahead of its time, and while many were disappointed not to see a Secret of Mana sequel, it's now considered to be fairly high quality for the era, and remains popular amongst gamers even now. The lead programmer, Brian Fedrow, was interviewed by Nintendo Life in 2009, and described the experience as being like a pioneer in a big new world. They built the team, the tools, and the story from scratch. The music composer was new to the business at the time, but Jeremy Soule went on to be one of the biggest names in the industry. Square's mother company wanted Secret of Mana Americanized, and that's exactly what they got. But it was almost something much darker. First, let me explain the final version for those who haven't played or can't remember. When the game begins, it's 1965 in the small town of Podunk, where an experiment is about to conclude. We enter a mansion to see a strange machine, and, when activated, the screen flashes white in what appears to be an explosion. When we return, it's 30 years later. The hero is a boy and his dog who wander inside the now abandoned mansion. After discovering the machine, the dog chews on some loose wires, and they are transported to a space station called Omnitopia. When the boy wakes, he's greeted by a robotic butler named Carlton, who ushers him past Professor Ruffelberg and into an escape pod. They crash land at a jungle, and the dog has been transformed into a wolf. This region is called Prehistoria, and its ruler is a young girl called Fire Eyes. But ultimately, we learn her real name is Elizabeth, and she is the professor's granddaughter. They were the owners of the mansion all those years before. Ruffelberg built a machine that could transport people into worlds created by their imagination, and this one was created by Elizabeth's love of dinosaurs. After the hero rescues her alchemist, she learns someone is tampering with her volcano, and if the boy can stop them, she will help him return to Podunk. Inside the volcano, Elizabeth's evil robotic twin has taken over the nearby dinosaurs and is planning to cause an ice age. Once her monster is defeated, she forces the volcano to erupt, and the hero is sent flying into the next region. Horace Highwater is the curator of the Podunk Museum and a friend of the professor's. He specializes in early civilizations and used the machine to create Antiquia by combining ancient Greek, Roman, and Egyptian cultures. When the experiment failed, he moved into the archaeological camp, leaving his advisor to keep an eye on the capital city, Nobilia. Eventually, Horace's evil twin appeared and took over the city in less than a week, immediately setting his sights on a set of powerful ancient jewels. After mistaking the boy's newly transformed greyhound for the sacred dog, the hero is forced to fight the gladiator champion, Tiny, before being sent to locate the Diamond Eyes. Horace helps the boy locate the jewels, but they are stolen by his twin shortly after the hero retrieves them. The robotic double uses the Diamond Eyes to create a monster, and, once it's defeated, the real Horace returns to Nobilia. Finally, the monster's power core explodes, opening an underground tunnel to the next region. Another friend of the professor's, a librarian, Camellia Bluegarden, created a medieval land of castles and dragons. She ruled Gothica from Ebon Keep with the king until her evil twin locked her in the dungeon and took her place. Next, the imposter put the king to sleep with a hypnotic puppet show and built a new fortress across the Great Ravine. The hero wins a chance to have dinner in Ivor Tower, but when the dog, now a poodle, destroys the meal, The fake queen tasks him with crossing the ravine. She needs him to lower the drawbridge so they can clear out the last of the rebels, and she's willing to set him free if he succeeds. Of course, once the hero is in Ebon Keep, he meets the real queen and learns the truth. Once the imposter's extremely creepy puppets are destroyed, she throws herself off the balcony in an attempt to squash the hero, breaking into pieces in the process. As a reward, the boy is given a flying machine to gather materials for a rocket capable of reaching the space station. Omnitopia is the control center of Evermore and was created from Ruffelberg's own imagination. At the space station, the hero is finally able to speak with the professor, and he learns that they have all been trapped in the Evermore simulation for 30 years due to the robotic butler, Carlton. Carlton was designed to perform basic housework duties, but the professor also wanted a worthy chess opponent. Unfortunately, he made his adversary a little too smart, and the robot sabotaged his experiment. He wanted to take control of Evermore for himself. Once they were stranded, he began making duplicates of the others along with the various creatures in each region. When Carlton is defeated, the professor deactivates him, and Evermore begins to destabilize. Everyone is forced to return to Podunk before it explodes. Overall, it's a very simple concept for a kid's game, and it had not been for one blogger, I would have never thought to look any deeper. In 2010, questions were raised on the blog Rainwood Works, and now, all these years later, I finally have the answers. For those who aren't familiar with the original post, I'll give you a quick rundown. It centers around a young man named Ed Kahn who apparently won the lead writer's position through a contest. Sometime before the game's release, Ed separated from the project, but the company never confirmed whether he quit or was fired. His name doesn't appear anywhere in the credits, which suggests none of his material made it into the final product. It's possible Kahn's work didn't fit in with the KA rating. Rainwood references a disturbing short story the writer became known for titled The Noise Coming From Inside Children to support this theory. And, considering I now have the original dialogue, I can confirm it is absolutely not KA rated. If we look at the game again with this information in mind, we begin to see hints of a darker theme in what was left behind. From the piles of dark, gritty concept art not seen in the actual game, to the title screen's deep, pounding music. Little clues were there all along. Wanting to get past the rumors, Rainwood reached out to one of the original programmers who recalled the art department having more control over development than usual. Their team was under the impression Secret of Evermore was meant to be dark, and were surprised to play a quirky kids game at the end. Next, Rainwood presents a gaming magazine that includes pictures of Evermore screenshots. In one, Elizabeth is saying, "How can you live with what you've done? Those poor children," to the hero. Whether this is further proof of something darker or just the punchline to a bad joke was only conjecture before now. While it's nowhere to be found in the official version, it is in mine. Finally, Brian Fedrow was also quoted as saying the game was 50 to 70 megabits before compression, a massive leap from the final 24 it launched with. They quote, "had to do lots of work on text compression towards the end. There was a huge amount of work to be done in that area for various reasons." So that about sums it up. This post always stuck with me, and I would think of it every time I played the game. Eventually, I decided to try investigating it for myself. I only meant to Google a few things, but I ended up on the dark web and, well, basically, one thing led to another, which led to another, that I will likely take to my grave. But I found it. It's got a few bugs, but overall, it's nothing like what was released. Square was so mortified by Kahn's work, they scrubbed his name from everything and hired new writers to fix it. That's the only possible conclusion. So, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I give you the original Secret of Evermore. Professor Ruffelberg is a mad scientist incapable of trusting anyone, even his granddaughter and closest friends. Carlton is actually just Carlton, a clone of the professor himself. The invention is meant to create simulations from someone's imagination, but not in a good way. Ruffelberg wants to send people into their worst fears in order to break them. he aspires for nothing less than complete global domination. In the opening scene, Elizabeth is told to go play outdoors, away from the experiment, but argues, "Outside is hot and dirty. I want a beautiful castle with air conditioning." This infuriates Ruffelberg, and he allows her to stay. While making adjustments to the machine, he thinks, sending her back to the dawn of time will teach her a lesson, before the screen flashes white. Elizabeth spent her first few weeks starving in the jungle before being rescued by an alchemist who took her under his wing. He brings her back to the village where she quickly masters flame attacks and earns the nickname Fire Eyes. But she never stops despising Prehistoria. She thinks Evermore and its inhabitants are only illusions, and she sees nothing wrong with practicing her alchemy on the villagers. Eventually, she devises an escape plan. If she were to send Prehistoria into an ice age, it may be enough to disrupt Evermore's calibration. When her clone appears soon after, she mistakenly believes the professor sent it to murder her. Elizabeth flees the village, and the clone takes her place. That's right, in the original version, it's the clone we meet upon arriving, and the real Elizabeth inside the volcano. Once her monster is defeated, she decides death is better than spending one more day in Prehistoria. The boy begs her not to do it, but she thinks he is one of her grandfather's minions. After failing to convince her otherwise, she declares, "If I can't escape, I'll burn with it." Horace Highwater is a shy, quiet man who dreamed of becoming an archaeologist, but his severe anxiety and fear of insects force him to settle for a museum curator. It's difficult to explore sites of ancient civilizations and make groundbreaking discoveries when you can't enter a jungle or a desert. It's no wonder his mind's worst nightmare threw him into a world where only the strong survived. He's not living in the archaeological camp by choice, but because he fled Nobelia after waking to find an assassin in his room. It was in the first month of his arrival. During the previous evening's dinner, a spider caused him to jump up with a shrill yelp. If there's one thing these citizens don't tolerate, it's cowardice. Horace managed to escape the city, but his new life has made him bitter and more paranoid than ever. His clone was able to gain control over the city by concealing his face, until he had proven himself a fearless leader. While it never says how he proved himself, any person you spoke to in the area would include some line about being terrified of the man. In the tavern on Crustacea Beach, the bartender says the citizens are fleeing in terror, and there are several references to mass executions. The people in the city speak like prisoners. Some have missing family members who are dragged away by guards, but when they visit in the dungeons, there's no record of them. Others have friends who fled in the night and have no idea if they survived the attempt. A few simply say, "How could he?" Horace doesn't care if Nobelia's mysterious new leader is a saint or Satan. Neither would help him get home. Like Elizabeth, he is also suspicious when the boy appears, but ultimately agrees to help locate the Diamond Eyes in hopes of returning to Podunk with him, until he learns what his clone accomplished with the people of Nobelia. After the imposter is defeated and the tunnel to Gothica is opened, Horace decides it would be safer to play both sides. He sends the boy ahead, claiming there are things to set right in Nobelia, when, in reality, he intends to assume the clone's identity. He believes it is better to serve the professor and rule Antiquia as a king than risk another day in that miserable camp. If the boy finds a way home to Podunk, great, but he doesn't think the odds are very good. Camellia Bluegarden is terrified of everything. Due to a brutal attack in her past, she moved into the library attic and only leaves when absolutely necessary. The depth that describes her assault is reason enough to scrub the storyline. How anyone could have written it into a children's game is mind-blowing. One night, after a late movie, two men dressed as clowns attacked her while she unlocked her car. They shoved her inside and drove into the alley where they remained for the worst 15 minutes of the poor woman's life, since the librarian lived like monsters were lurking just outside her door. Gothica became a world where actual dragons loom overhead, waiting to scoop up a snack. And court jesters were everywhere. Over the years, Camellia hardened herself and found a way to survive. After finding the strongest man in the region, she proposed a marriage that would make him king. She only wanted two things in return. First, all of the jesters would be banished from Ebon Keep, and second, she never wanted to go outside again. This arrangement worked surprisingly well until the clone arrived. With Camellia's habit of remaining secluded in her tower, the imposter was easily able to lock her away and assume her place. The only witnesses were a pair of servants, and they were swiftly silenced. Their corpses were used to create the puppet monsters, which were plenty creepy before learning they were actually dead bodies. The next notable change comes when the dog ruins the fake queen's dinner. Instead of being sentenced to a night in the dungeon, they are to be executed the following morning. Ultimately, she offers to let them live if they can poison the food in Ebon Keep, and the hero decides it's better to play along than lose his head. The truth is revealed when he meets the real queen and her inventor, Tinker. After the evil queen is defeated and leaps from the balcony, the hero looks into the hole and sees so much blood. Instead of gear-like in the real version, Tinker rewards the boy with the flying machine, but he must collect a few things before the inventor can get him to Omnitopia. When he returns to Prehistoria, Elizabeth shares more than just tips on where to find the items he needs. The clone also finds it too hot in her region and thinks her original copy's idea for an ice age may have potential. There are a few sinister hints of something dark happening behind the scenes when she alludes to test subjects and lab accidents, but no specific details are given. When the hero retrieves the diamond eyes, there isn't much of a difference in dialogue until Tiny is defeated. He has still become the leader of the Oglins, but he says it is because of Horus. He couldn't tolerate working for a coward and wanted to take the city by force. Luckily for the people of Nobelia, losing to the boy makes him realize he needs more training, and Tiny cancels the attack. Now, the hero can finally return to the space station. The professor admits he wanted to make a machine that would allow him to break even the strongest mind, but he isn't sorry. It was never meant to hold people prisoner for years at a time. By his calculations, the most resilient should be compliant or dead within the first week. If it weren't for Carlton, his plan would have worked perfectly. The professor should have known a copy of himself would never settle for being a butler. Carlton was working against him from the very beginning. He manipulated the experiment to make Evermore permanent, and then got to work on the clones. Once all three were in place, he would dispose of the professor and set his sights on the rest of the world, even though he is obviously lying. Ruffelberg says he has seen the error in his ways and wants a second chance to use his intellect for good. Carlton is hiding somewhere in the station. The professor is terrified of what he plans to do next, but if the boy can defeat him, they can end the experiment once and for all. When confronting Carlton, he is even more bitter than promised. He rants about how he was treated as less than human simply because he was conceived in a tube instead of a womb. His only aspirations are to make the professor suffer every indignity he himself endured, and to replace each person with their own clone so he can never again be discriminated against. Once he is defeated, Ruffelberg arrives to stab him in the back before turning on some electrical coils that zap the clone into oblivion. The world begins to shake, and it's determined that the simulation has been thrown out of balance. Now, the hero must collect Elizabeth, Horus, and Camellia before Evermore collapses. While the curator and librarian are hesitant to return to the professor, it doesn't take much to convince them. Elizabeth, however, is a different story. The fact that Ruffelberg's granddaughter died seems to be of little consequence. No one appears to care that it was the clone who survived. When the hero returns to Prehistoria, the girl doesn't want to leave. Her experiment is on the verge of success, and she believes that the other's departure will be enough to restore balance. But even if it doesn't, she would rather die in Evermore than return to Podunk. Elizabeth doesn't care that she is gambling with the lives of an entire world instead of just her own, and we learn it's because she still shares the original's belief that none of the people are real. That's why she has been using children in her volcano experiments. Given they are in a prehistoric era, she wondered if there might be an ancient god who required sacrifices. Countless children were thrown into the volcano at various times, in different ways. But she is somehow surprised none of her efforts have affected the region's temperature. Yet. Basically, Elizabeth is a psychopath just like her grandfather. So, It's actually the boy who says the line from Rainwood's screenshot, "How can you live with what you've done? Those poor children." Was definitely not just a punchline. Finally, when they're all back in Podunk, the hero is glad they're home and asks the group if they'd be able to work past their differences. Ruffelberg says, "I guarantee it. In fact, we're ready to get started right away." While the others each respond with, "Please, don't leave us alone with him." Needless to say, Square probably made the right decision in the end. This episode of The Dark Side of Gaming was brought to you by The Dark Swamp Entertainment and produced by Swamp Dweller, backed by Audioboom. The heart-pounding sound design was produced by Joey Sorlis, and the creepy mysteries in this episode were brought together by Paige Turner. These dark tales were voiced and hosted by TDN. Be sure to follow the podcast on iTunes and Spotify to get notified as soon as a new episode comes out. And don't forget to rate it to let us know how we did. And leave a comment on what you would like to hear be covered in a future episode.